Let's say we do find signs of life on Mars, it will be on the front page of every newspaper. But I think within a few days, the next morning, people have moved on to, well, what are the Kardashians up to again?
Today's episode of the podcast, number 2 in the series on other worlds, I speak with Lewis Dartnell. Lewis is an astrobiologist and author, and today he discusses the series of contradictions that we have on the topic of life elsewhere. Life on Earth is somehow special, yet there is an abundance of Earth-like planets within our universe. Life is fragile, yet life always finds a way. So, in this conversation, we discuss what is significant in astrobiology, why it matters to us, its effects on society, and ultimately, what that means for humanity and for the future. Lewis is also a fantastic author, having written books such as Life in the Universe, A Beginner's Guide, which offers a deeper dive into what we talked about today. Find out more in the show notes or at lewisdartnell.com.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care, he wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Contradiction here, which is life always finds a way, it thrives under all circumstances, yet at the same time Earth is in this perfect Goldilocks zone, and if the axial tilt was a degree this way, everything would be catastrophic. Now, where, I'm sure there's truth to either side of it, but where do you think the reality sort of lies?
Yeah, I think you're right there, Connor, that there are a number of features about planet Earth that seem to be fortuitously set up or arranged to allow for life. But I think the source of the first of those apparent contradictions is when we say life, in fact, that covers an enormous breadth of different things. So while it might be true that if the actual tilt of the Earth was slightly off or we didn't have a large moon to stabilize our axis being largely upright, that is important for complex multicellular life, like you or I and your listeners. But perhaps these extremophile hardy bacteria wouldn't care all that much if the Earth were swinging backwards and forth with this obliquity and swinging in and out of ice ages. You know, bacteria are quite happy surviving through ice ages. More complex life, if it went through a sort of snowball Earth event, are less happy about it. So there's all these this range of diversity from single-celled, simple, primitive, if you like, bacterial-like life through eukaryotic cells, multicellular life forms, all the way up to the sort of complex ecosystems that require to support things like you or I. And so the Earth is special in those respects for complex life, but maybe most of those aren't actually all that relevant for sustaining hardier life, extremophile, single-celled life. But I think that there's something else here, Connor, that you hinted at about extremophiles and life will find a way. And in all these different nasty, hostile environments that we've now been surveying and searching for life, whether that's boiling pools of hot volcanic water or deep inside glaciers or acidic conditions or alkaline conditions, and we end up finding life in all of these incredibly intolerable situations. This teaches us that life can adapt to many different environments. But it kind of presupposes a deeper question there, which is, well, how does life get started in the first place? Once you have a cell, it can evolve and adapt. But the range of conditions that are required for the origins of life, the genesis of life in the first place, are probably a great deal more constrained than the conditions that life can adapt to after once it's got a cell, once it's got a membrane, once it can control its environment, once it can run metabolism. So actually probably the deeper question in astrobiology is not where do extremophiles on Earth survive, but what is required for the origin of life in the first place? And we're much further away from an answer to that, I think.
What do you mean by we're further away from, and it might sound like a bit of a silly question, but in what way and how can you actually pursue that sort of answer?
Well, so I mean, in terms of the extremophiles, for quite a while now, for several decades, microbiologists have been checking these hostile environments, these extreme environments, and lo and behold, where previously people hadn't even bothered to check,
right.
Oh yeah, look, there is life there, we just hadn't anticipated it, or we were looking in the wrong way, we're using the wrong molecular techniques, and life is there. But the field of studying the origins of life is in many ways much less developed, simply because the biochemistry required to get from some kind of mushy soup of primordial prebiotic compounds, things like amino acids or nucleotide bases, how you get from that prebiotic organic soup into something that is even a shadow of the complexity of a single bacterial cell is an incredibly complex process that we're trying to explore in laboratories. It's just a very long, slow process of exploration.
I mean, it's interesting there as well, because you're sort of discussing something that I guess has numerous influences, whether it be social or scientific, is that we actually, life, the way that we think about life, and maybe the way that we even respect life or understand the importance of life, really is across quite a large spectrum. And I remember a podcast I had quite a while ago now with an astrophysicist, Alan Duffy in Australia. He was talking about the idea of discovering life elsewhere. And he said something that, you know, really quite sat with me, which is, if we discovered life elsewhere, if it was something that is much more likely, as you had mentioned, and some sort of bacterial life, he thinks that actually that wouldn't, it would be front page news for the first couple of days, and then people would quite readily forget it. So as sort of an astrobiologist, do you find, I guess difficulty isn't the correct word, but do you find that it is difficult to sort of project any research, project any interest from yourself or from the public towards the right direction, bearing in mind that maybe simple life isn't quite as exciting or quite as significant as something more?
Yeah, I think I'd actually be inclined to agree with that. But let's say we do find signs of life on Mars, it will be on the front page of every newspaper or website probably nowadays around the world. But I think within a few days, the next morning, people have moved on to, well, what are the Kardashians up to again? Let's go back to the sort of things that we just gossip
reality.
And about anyway. Let's get back to reality, exactly. Yeah. And even with the first suggestions coming out of particle accelerators just last week, that there might be forces of physics which have previously been unsuspected, that the standard model seems to not quite provide a complete description of the particles we're now finding coming out of things like the Large Hadron Collider, that has already slipped back out of the news cycle. And that is potentially incredibly profound as well. So I don't think, I think it's expected that we will make big discoveries like this, and they will soon move back out of the popular press, and then the general public won't be talking about them again, even though they still remain scientifically profound. But I don't think that's a problem, because you will still be able to engage the public with what has been found. You can still talk to journalists, go on TV, do documentaries, do talks in schools, and just keep pushing it back up into people's perception.
Quite a deep question. I suppose it's quite philosophical and more about sociology than anything. But why do you think that is? Why do you think it's, although it is incredibly significant, both on what it is for us to be human, but also on a scientific level, why do you think it is that the general public sort of it's likely to be pushed in the background so quickly?
Well, I think it's that there are lots of things which are incredibly significant. We were going through a global pandemic at the moment, so the newspapers are preoccupied with not what is the most significant thing in the long term to report. They are preoccupied with what has happened recently that our readers might want to read about. And that engenders this kind of very rapid turnover of what has become known as the news cycle, particularly with 24-hour news channels. If you've got your anchors having to talk about something for 24 hours of every day, that gives you a quick turnover. You need to keep finding the new thing to talk about. But like I say, that Mars, for example, is in and out of the headlines.
Right.
That you don't just have one headline and everyone moves on. There was a huge amount of press coverage with the landing of the Mars Science Laboratory mission landing with Perseverance. There's been a huge amount of hubbub today at the point of recording this podcast with you about the Ingenuity helicopter drone that's had its first test flight. So each new advance, each new step pushes things back up into the public awareness.
So, I mean, the other thing as well, I guess on the flip side to that, opposite to that, is discussions of you know, life elsewhere in whatever forms, particularly with Mars. You know, humans do have an obsession with Mars more so than the other planets. It's a part of it is a part of the general conversation, I would argue, way more than most other science, right? And you can probably talk about that much more than me, about sort of talks and stuff you've had about astrobiology that might spurn interest a lot more than other things that people might consider boring. So again, I suppose it's opposite to the previous question that I asked, but why do you think it does ignite such desire and passion and excitement in people when some new type of material science might not?
Yeah, I think astrobiology, in the sort of the education and outreach and public communication aspects of astrobiology, I do, and in a way, I'm pushing against an open door. It is ludicrously easy to get school children, adults, grandparents excited about astrobiology. I think because it's something that people are already interested in. It is attempting to answer the sort of questions that people have mulled over with their children, or when you're six asking, you know, what's out there in the night sky. Mm. It's the sort of conversation you might have with your mates in a pub asking for a loan, or if UFOs are real, or if there might be life out there in the Milky Way somewhere. So astrobiology is a field of science tapping into something which is this very primeval question. And we've been asking that question before science itself existed as an enterprise. You know, are we alone? Is there other beings like us out there in the night sky that we can see? So I think that's why astrobiology or astrobiologists find it relatively easy to engage the public, because they don't have to work hard to get the public interested in it, because they already were. And I think also it's some aspects of it are relatively easy to understand. People have an interaction with life already. They kind of know what you're talking about.
Yeah, good point.
That there's lots about the planets and moons already, so they kind of get the basic concepts that we're dealing with, they already understand. Whereas, as you say, some nuance of quantum physics or some new material science, it's kind of invisible and behind the scenes.
Right.
So it's you have to first convince someone that it's relevant to them and why they should be interested, and then deliver the payload, as it were. Whereas with astrobiology, that first step has effectively already been done for you.
It's strange, isn't it? Like, immunologists really don't know what to do with themselves right now, because about 2 years ago, no one cared about the lowly immunologist, and now they're
everyone's
probably
now an armchair expert.
Exactly,
isn't it? Exactly,
that's right. Everyone's getting asked to do interviews and whatever else it might be. We kind of jumped over, I guess, some of the basic steps of what I wanted to talk about, because there's a couple of things you mentioned that I thought would be a good idea to jump onto now. But as you had mentioned before, you were discussing the fact that more complex life, what we consider life, is a complete far cry from the realities of what we might expect of finding life elsewhere. Not only that, that's a huge far cry from what is that ignition? What is that first step where there's no life and suddenly it is life? So that kind of brings us, I suppose, a little bit onto your first book, from what I've seen about it as well, is what places are we actually looking for life, and why are we looking for them there? Why are we looking for it there? What is, I suppose, significant places around the universe that might be more likely to harbor life rather than others?
Yeah, the prime real estate, as it were, for astrobiologists in the solar system are places that, as far as we can tell, offer today or have offered an environment which we think is habitable, an environment that is suitable for life to have got started and for life to have survived until today, so we can then go and look for it. And so our next door neighbour planet, Mars, as we've already discussed, is somewhere that a lot of astrobiologists talk about. As far as we can tell from our exploration programme of Mars, it's once been a much warmer, wetter planet. It once had a warm aqueous environment, seas and rivers and lakes on its surface, a lot of interesting organic chemistry on the surface of Mars. And a planet that was therefore supportive of biology to get started. But also Mars is lucky in the sense that it is Earth-like in several respects, but not Earth-like in others. But also it happens to be our next door neighbour, so it's much easier for us to explore. So I think that's why a lot of attention has been focused on Mars, is that the sort of the cost implications, but also the technological level that you need to pull off a successful mission to Mars is a lower bar than some of the other places in the solar system we would dearly like to explore. And these are places like Europa or Enceladus, some of the icy moons in the outer solar system, orbiting Jupiter or Saturn, orbiting the gas giant planets, where we think there is a habitable environment, perhaps even today, beneath the surface of these moons, that there's basically extraterrestrial oceans in these icy moons, which offer, we think, a habitable environment, but also are nigh on impossible to get to and explore with robots, with probes. So there's this ongoing sort of debate in astrobiology between Mars, which is easy to get to, but probably doesn't have a habitable environment today, versus Europa, for example, which is probably habitable today, but it's a nightmare to try to get to and operate probes on its surface or getting beneath kilometers of solid ice and into that ocean.
And it sort of brings up an interesting question as well, to the point where when astrobiologists or physicists are sort of analyzing things or places around the solar system that are more likely to harbor life, what are the specifics we're looking at? And also, it's probably quite difficult, I imagine, to be as unbiased as possible, because as we've discussed, there is a certain fascination or obsession that humans have with life elsewhere, and that probably is quite difficult to remove that anthropological outlook that it's almost impossible not to have. What kind of things, when you're analyzing where to go, are you sort of trying to identify, and how are you identifying it?
Yeah, we try to be as we try to avoid being terracentric as far as possible. You have to accept, as an astrobiologist, that life may not be like us. There might be many different alternative biochemistries that could build a cell. Life might look very different to cells on Earth, to bacteria on Earth. It might have different chemistries. But also, on the other hand, as an astrobiologist, you are a scientist. You've got to base your hypotheses and your predictions and what you're looking for on what you have already established. And of course, we know that life on Earth is possible. And we can study life on Earth and see how it works and know that that particular system is viable. So it makes sense, for example, to look for life on Mars that is water-based and carbon-based, or look for that sort of life in the universe and in the solar system in general, because we know that sort of life works, because we are an instance of that sort of life. We're an example of it. But also, for another very good reason, is that we have spent a lot of time getting very good at designing experiments and instruments to find that kind of life. And that's everything from being in a hospital and taking a blood test to see if you have septicemia or an infection, or finding bacteria we shouldn't have them on Earth, or exploring some of these extremophile locations like the Atacama Desert or Antarctica. We've got very good at finding that kind of life on Earth. So it stands to reason that we should therefore, at least in the first attempts, be looking for that kind of life on somewhere like Mars. Life that we know is possible, and B, life that we know we've got quite good at finding. And then I suspect, as astrobiology matures as a discipline, and maybe we turn up, you know, we come up empty-handed on Mars or maybe Europa, maybe we start rethinking it. Are we looking in the wrong way, or are we looking in the wrong place? Should we start casting that much further afield and maybe pay more attention to extrasolar planets, planets orbiting other stars in the galaxy?
And there's something that you mentioned there that I think anybody who's watched probably 50% of the sci-fi out there, or at least Star Trek for sure, mentioning water and carbon. Now, what are the significance of water and carbon versus other compounds and other solutions?
Yeah, so all life on Earth is water-based. We use liquid water as the wet stuff in our cells, as the solvent for dissolving all the important biomolecules, all the important chemistry like DNA for storing information, or proteins and enzymes for running the kind of chemical reactions that life relies upon. And in many respects, you can open up a sort of a biochemistry textbook or an astrobiology textbook, and somewhere in the first chapter, it'll probably list all the things that water does that we think are essential for life.
Right.
It is a non-polar solvent. It can dissolve lots of different kinds of compounds. It expands when it freezes, which means it's hard to you know, freeze an entire ocean and et cetera. But again, when you think about it, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that life on Earth, which is a very watery place, it is a world where the major liquid is liquid water,
right,
happens to use liquid water. Right. Because of course you'd expect that. And if you were to go to the planet Zog, where they have lots of liquid methane or liquid ammonia or liquid whatever, perhaps they shouldn't be surprised, if they exist, that they are based on the wet stuff that is the most prominent thing around them. So again, we have that, and you introduced at the beginning of this interview, these sort of contradictions, or sort of paradoxes. Is life on Earth water-based because it happens to be loads of water? Or is water in some respect a prerequisite for life on many other places as well? Could you have alternatives to water that work just as well? And what a lot of people speculate about is that maybe liquid ammonia would be as good. Maybe you could have life that is methane-based. Mm-hmm. And that question is particularly pertinent because we know of a place that is absolutely drenched with liquid methane and ethane in our solar system, which is Titan, the giant moon orbiting Saturn. So trying not to be too blinkered about looking for life that is made in the same way that we are is one of the key, you know, key skills of an astrobiologist, whilst remaining rooted to what we know how to do and what we can build an experiment to test for. So that's water, and also all life on Earth is carbon-based. And actually being carbon-based does seem to be much more likely to be a universal of not just life on Earth and in our solar system, but across the galaxy and universe. Because carbon as an element, as an atom, is just so good at sticking to itself, forming carbon-carbon bonds,
right,
but also bonding to many other elements in the periodic table. Carbon oxygen, carbon nitrogen, carbon sulfur bonds are all strong and stable, and there is an incredible richness and diversity to carbon chemistry, to organic chemistry. Whereas the thing which is closest to carbon in the periodic table, what sits just below carbon in the next row down, is silicon. And in comparison, silicon is rubbish at doing chemistry. It doesn't have, you know, a fraction of the diversity of carbon chemistry, even though silicon is often held up in, I say, sci-fi as being an alternative for organic life, silicon-based life. That does seem to be less plausible.
Interesting. I think it's quite. I mean, this is true for all science, but it is this weird, I guess, disparity and struggle between trying to stick to what we know, what we know to be true, but at the same time understanding that the universe is a very, very big place and things might be different. And that's funny what you're saying about water, how we're so obsessed with it. Yet, just like you said, it's as if we're going to a steak restaurant and being surprised that everyone in there feels like steak or something like that. It's of course that's what it's going to be like.
Exactly. You're kind of presupposing your own question, aren't you?
Right.
There's an anthropic principle going on there.
Now, talking about, I guess, a step back even in terms of motivations and things for yourself personally and as a society and as academia as a whole, why do we even care? Why is it significant or important that we have this sort of mission to scour our solar system or even greater the universe to try and find life elsewhere? How is that going to affect me or the person next door? and why should, I suppose, why should people in the future continue to research it?
Well, I care personally as an individual, as a scientist, because I find it fascinating. I find it exciting and interesting for many different reasons. And that's why I've chosen to specialize as a research scientist in this interdisciplinary area of science, in astrobiology. But I think for any field of science, you can always ask that same question. Why is this important? Why should we bother? What's it going to do for society? Is it going to give you a new gadget in your pocket or invent a new cure for cancer or not? Like, how is this applicable? And I think in many ways that's the wrong question to ask, because often, in fact, always in science, when you're exploring something new, you don't know what the answer is going to be.
Right.
And if you already know what the answer is, it's not science. You're not exploring uncharted territory. So you can never know the answer. What is the point of doing this or trying to explore this? because you don't know what you'll find. You don't know what applications it might have. And there are, you know, umpteen classic examples from the history of science and technology about why would you bother looking into this really obscure area of solid state physics? Oh, because 20 years later, it gives you the laser, which has revolutionized how we communicate, how we store information, how we treat cancer, and all number of different spin-off technologies. And you could say the same about astrobiology as well, that whenever you try to do something hard that you haven't been able to do before, you will invariably get spin-off technologies. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of spin-off technologies from space exploration, human spaceflight, or the robotic exploration of Mars as well. And in particular, if you're trying to design a Mars rover to have experiments on board, to have instruments on board that therefore have to be very small, so you can fit them in the pointy end of a rocket and launch them to another planet. They have to be very low power because they'll often be solar powered instruments. They have to be, small size, low weight. Those are also exactly the sort of attributes you need, for example, of having portable equipment that you can take out into sub-Saharan Africa and start testing people's blood or their breath for signs of disease. So there are specific examples of spin-off technology from astrobiology and exploring Mars that are now being taken into villages that are far, far from hospitals for public health applications. And that is a direct application of of astrobiology and space exploration.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? We even on a personal levels, we really struggle to do things if there isn't some distinctive and clear path, even just a little bit down the road. It's quite a small example, but I remember when I was at university, I was studying physics. And when I just started, people kept asking me, like, what type of physics are you going to be interested in, going to study? And I didn't know yet what I didn't know. It was a very strange and bizarre question for me to receive. And some of the people sort of reacted as if I was wayward and listless. And I didn't know. It seemed quite unfair to me at the moment. It was a bit strange. But sort of going off on top of that as well is there are so many times, as you had mentioned, when we talk about lasers and things like that, and quantum mechanics is probably the most famous example where people at the turn of the sort of 19th to 20th century made all these discoveries with quantum mechanics and was entirely and completely unusable. And yet now here we are using just about everything to do with quantum mechanics as we possibly can. So I guess it's good to think that there are actually things down the road. For you, more on a personal note, I suppose, what was your original motivations, be it philosophically, be it industry-wise, that kind of got you into it?
So I started off as a biologist. I came from a biological background, and that's what I studied at university as an undergraduate, and then moved to University College London, UCL, and got involved in a deliberately interdisciplinary department at UCL at the time, where they took biologists like myself with physicists like yourself, computer programmers, mathematicians, and trained us up for a master's / PhD program, where for the PhD portion of that, they quite literally handed you a suitcase full of cash and said, here is your PhD funding. Go do whatever you want to do for your PhD. Go pick a subject that you're passionate about that is on the interface of biology and something else, and go pick your own supervisors, go write your own PhD question, your own title for your thesis, basically, and then run with it. And it was that incredible opportunity. Even today, that's pretty much unheard of in terms of the flexibility you're given as a PhD student to direct your own course from the very earliest stage. But it was that opportunity at UCL that I was able to say, well, thanks ever so much for my suitcase full of cash. I'd like to spend the next 3 years of my life in my PhD working in this area of astrobiology, applying biological sciences on Earth to the possibility of life on places beyond that. So I got into it because of that opportunity, but also because of just an intrinsic interest and passion and fascination in that as an area of exploration. And maybe if, 10, 20 years ago, if I'd had the same opportunity, astrobiology perhaps wouldn't have been developed enough to kind of be able to do a valid PhD in it. In many respects, astrobiology is one of the newer areas of interdisciplinary science that's been made possible by developments in robotics and exploration of the solar system, or telescopes exploring planets orbiting other stars in the solar system, or genetics and molecular biology advances to understand the origins of life and extremophiles on Earth. So in many respects, it's one of the newest, freshest forms of science. And on the other hand, it's one of the most ancient questions, as we said already, that people have been asking. It's, you know, it's the sort of tension between those two.
Yeah, it's interesting that almost more often than not, the timing of science is actually the most crucial thing. We're so often not able to do something because of whatever technology we have or whatever knowledge is available.
And not having the tools to be able to explore something neat.
Right. Now, as we're sort of drawing to the last portion of the podcast, I wanted to, honestly, it's a bit kind of horrible questions for you, because they're questions that people have discussed and never had an answer for, and yet I'm going to sit here and expect that you have an answer. but as it's sort of bordering on physics now, talking about things like the Drake equation, why is life just so uncommon? You know, I was speaking to, in the same series, with someone from SETI, and, you know, we're estimating that there could be 300 million Earth-like planets in sort of our galaxy, and that's an amazingly huge number. Yet aliens aren't landing and communicating with us all the time. So the question is, where are they?
where is everybody?
Yeah, where is everybody?
So again, there is a distinction. There's kind of a cleavage between SETI and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, i.e. complex, multicellular, intelligent, civilization-building, technology-inventing, space-faring aliens, which humans have now sort of taken a step into. That SETI and astrobiology is more preoccupied with simple bacterial, hardy-like life, like extremophiles. And there's an important distinction between those two different forms of life. Clearly, in order to get intelligent, space-faring aliens, you have to have started with bacteria and then had about 3-4 billion years of evolution on a stable planet to get from A to B, as it were, to give evolution the chance to produce an intelligent alien for you. But you also look for those two different forms of alien life in very different ways. The assumption of SETI is that intelligent, technological, star-faring life would be self-reporting. We would have to listen passively, and it would tell us that it's there, either deliberately by broadcasting a message of, hey, Earth, let's have a chat, so, you know, sending us into interstellar tweet, or sort of inadvertently revealing their existence to us because we see, you know, their own communications, or we see evidence of their mega engineering and their Dyson spheres or whatever. But we can basically passively do that from Earth, or by launching telescopes into space. But with finding primitive life, bacterial life, we have to be much more active about it. We have to physically go to Mars to sift through, you know, robotic scoopfuls of Martian soil to test the chemistry to see if there might have been life there. So we go about those two different searches in different ways. And the Drake equation that you mentioned already, in fact, I don't think has ever really been used by SETI or astrobiology researchers in any kind of meaningful sense. Without being disrespectful, the Drake equation is basically a gross irrelevance.
Right.
And I've spoken to Frank Drake about it, and firstly, he refuses to ever call it the Drake equation. It's just the equation that he and some other people at a meeting came up with.
Interesting.
But I think he'd agree with me that it was never ever intended to be predictive. It was never intended to plug in some numbers into the terms of the equation and come up with a magic number at the end, because it's philosophically impossible to come up with an answer at the end of it, because number of the terms, you cannot know what that number is a priori. You can't predict it. You can only calculate it after the event. So one of the later terms in the Drake equation is how many Earth-like planets with life on them develop intelligence.
Right.
You can't calculate that from first principles. The only way you can ever get an answer to that number is to find, let's say, 100 Earth-like planets with life on them, work out how many of them have got intelligent life on it, divide one by that's how you get your percentage, but you can't get it ahead of time. So the Drake equation is interesting, and it was only ever intended to break down a complex problem into smaller bite-sized chunks you could then address one by one. And we've been filling in the Drake equation terms from the left over the recent decades as we've explored the solar system and built more and more for more and more powerful telescopes in outer space. But what is interesting is you might conclude that the probability of life emerging was a high probability, it was a probable event, it was a likely event, and yet we see no evidence for that intelligent life in our galaxy. And maybe the conclusion for that is that, well, in fact, intelligent life is not common. Bacterial life might be common, but maybe intelligent life is not. So somewhere between the emergence of life on an Earth-like planet and 3.5 billion years later, intelligent life, somewhere there must be some kind of hurdle or stumbling block that evolution doesn't regularly or often get beyond.
Right.
And that itself is a huge area of research.
And there's one thing that you just briefly touched on then too, which I think shows that people often, I suppose people often look at it as quite a static problem, but the timescales that we're discussing here are absolutely huge as well. And you know, again, with one of your previous books, you know quite a lot about, I suppose, the fragility of the possibility of civilizations or life itself even breaking down. You know, 99% of all species have gone extinct. So we're keeping that in mind as well. How much, I guess, respect do you put onto the fact that these timescales could be the actual largest factor that are involved with the search for life?
Yeah, so it does take many billions of years, we think, for life, for evolution to progress from simple single-celled bacteria to complex multicellular advanced life. But on the other hand, there's nothing special about now. There's nothing special about this moment in the history of our galaxy, of the Milky Way. And if you accept that as sort of an axiom of your argument, then there's no reason to suppose that life didn't get started on another Earth-like planet somewhere else in the Milky Way galaxy, our galaxy, a million years before us, 10 million years, 100 million years, maybe a billion years before us. So although these sort of timescales we're talking about can be very, very large, we would still expect to see a broad distribution of ages of solar systems, ages of planets, ages of ecosystems, and maybe civilizations on those planets across the Milky Way. You know, this is an extension of the Copernican principle that the Earth isn't special. It's not the center of the solar system, the center of the universe. There's nothing special about our place, but also is nothing special about our time, about now. So if there is another intelligent species in our Milky Way, you'd in fact expect it to be vastly ahead of us in terms of its technological development.
Interesting. And just as a last sort of point, I like to, with all the academics or whoever I speak to, like to sort of ask them the kind of like the crystal ball question. When we're looking into the future, especially for yourself, who might be more involved with or relevant with current research, what is actually happening more than we see on the news. Pick any sort of time scale you like, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years. What do you expect for us to see, I suppose, in the field of astrobiology?
I think the next 20 years certainly are going to be a hugely exciting period in astrobiology, not least because the flurry of robots we are sending or about to send to Mars. Perseverance, we've already mentioned. Later this year, ESA, the European Space Agency, will be sending its own next-generation, hyper-sophisticated, life-hunting robot called ExoMars. And there's also, in the pipeline, a very exciting mission being planned to not just miniaturize a laboratory and send it to Mars to do the experiments there, but to grab handfuls of Martian soil, Martian rocks, and bring them back to the Earth so we can then study and analyze with all the labs around the world, known as a Mars sample return mission. And 20 years is the sort of time scale we're talking about for that. And then if we're looking into the galaxy as a whole, again, 20 years is a really exciting time scale for these not only planet detecting telescopes, mm-hmm. but planet characterizing telescopes. We ought to be able to, if they're there, within 20 years' time, have surveyed the atmosphere, the air, of several Earth-like planets in our neck of the woods, and seen if there are signs of an ecosystem of a biosphere there, and in particular, oxygen in the atmosphere. So hopefully for the rest of my career,
right.
it's going to be a very exciting, very fast moving period of time
right.
compared to the previous 20 years. It's very much sort of ramping up in its rate of exploration.
Right, just like we had mentioned from the changing technology and whatever else. Mm. Okay, Lewis, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. If anyone is sort of interested in what you had to say, they want to learn a little bit more about you and what you do, where can they go? What can they do?
All right, so they can hop into my website, which is lewisdartnall.com. If they're interested in what we've been talking about just now, about astrobiology and the search for life beyond the Earth, my first book, Life in the Universe, A Beginner's Guide, will tell them all about that.
Right.
If they would like to know how you could rebuild civilization after an apocalypse, after someone pushes a great big reset button on our current civilization, my previous book, The Knowledge, is all about that. And my most recent book, that came out just 2-3 years ago now, is called Origins, How the Earth Shaped Human History. And that looks at features of the planet we live on, the geology, plate tectonics, the atmosphere, the climate, and how those features of our planet have had a huge guiding influence on human history, on the story of civilizations and how we got to today. So not just within astrobiology do I, try to be quite interdisciplinary, look right. at lots of different fields, but also in the books and the science communication that I do as well.
Perfect. And I'll include some links as well for people to check out.
If you enjoyed what you listened to or have any feedback or just want to say hello, please help out by visiting The Blunt Report on social media, giving a rating, or even telling a friend about what you listened to. The podcast is available on all platforms, including video podcasts on YouTube, or can simply be found at thebluntreport.com.